Leader boy knees him in the groin and takes it from his associate.
Ooh, new. Nice.
Please, skinny boy gasps. It was a present for my birthday.
I don't think we got an invite to your party. Leader boy looks around at his cronies.
Did we?
Nah, must have got lost in the post.
Not a text, nothing.
Leader boy raises the phone high above his head. Skinny boy reaches for it, but it's half-hearted. He's got several inches on his tormentor, but he's already defeated. It's a look I recognize. Leader boy smirks.
I really hope I don't drop.
I grab his raised wrist.
You won't.
Leader boy twists his head around.
Who the fuck are you?
Mr. Thorne. Your new English teacher. But you can call me sir.
A collective murmur runs through the group. Leader boy's face falters, just a little. Then he smiles in a way I'm sure he thinks is charming. It makes me dislike him even more.
We were just having a laugh, sir. It was only a joke.
Really? I look at Skinny Boy. Were you having a laugh? He glances at Leader Boy and gives a small, slight nod.
Just joking around.
I release Leader Boy's wrist, reluctantly, and hand Skinny Boy back his phone.
If I were you, Marcus, I'd leave this at home tomorrow.
He nods again, doubly chastised now. I turn to Leader Boy.
Name?
Jeremy Hurst.
Hurst. I feel a small tick flutter by my eye. Of course, I should have realized.
The dark hair threw me, but now I can see the family resemblance. The hereditary glint of cruelty in his blue eyes.
Is that all, sir?
The sir is stressed, sarcastic. He wants me to bite. But that would be too easy.
Other days, I remind myself. Other days.
For now, I turn back to the others. The lot of you, get out of here. But if I see you so much as drop a bit of chewing gum in future, I'll be on you like a bad case of chlamydia. A couple almost let slip a smile despite themselves. I jerk my head towards the school gate and they start to saunter away. Hurst stands his ground longest, before finally turning and loping casually after them. Marcus lingers uncertainly.
You two, I tell him.
He still doesn't move.
What?
You shouldn't have done that.
You'd rather I let him get away with smashing up your new phone?
He shakes his head wearily and turns away.
You'll see.
5.
I don't have to wait long.
Lunch break. I'm at my desk, writing up some lesson notes and congratulating myself on having got through the morning without boring my classes to death or throwing a pupil or myself out of a window. As Harry quite rightly pointed out, it has been a while since I last taught. I admit I felt a little rusty. Then I remembered something an old colleague told me. Teaching is like riding a bike. You never really forget. And if you feel like you're about to wobble or fall off, always remember that there are 30 kids waiting to laugh at you and nick the bike. So keep pedaling, even if you have no idea where you're going. I kept pedaling. By the end of the morning, I was feeling pretty smug with my own success. Obviously, this can't last. There's a knock at the classroom door, and Harry pokes his head in.
Ah, Mr. Thorne, I'm glad I caught you. Everything okay?
Well, no one's fallen asleep in my lessons yet, so I'd have to say yes, he nods.
Good. Very good.
But it doesn't look like it's very good. He looks like a man who has lost a tenner and found a wasp's nest. He walks into the room and stands awkwardly in front of me.
I'm sorry to have to bring this up on your first day, but something has come to my attention that I can't ignore.
Crap, I think. This is it. He's followed up on my references and I've been rumbled. It was always a gamble. Debbie, the school secretary from my previous school, had a bit of a crush on me, and a bigger crush on expensive handbags. For old time's sake, and a small clutch, she intercepted Harry's request for a reference and forwarded it to me, along with some official-headed paper. Hence my glowing credentials. All well and good, unless Harry dug a little deeper. I brace myself. But that's not it. Apparently, there was an incident with one of our pupils outside the school gates this morning. If by incident you mean bullying, then yes. So you didn't assault a pupil? What? I've had a complaint from a pupil, Jeremy Hurst, that you assaulted him. The little shit. I feel a pulse begin to beat at the side of my head. He's lying. He said you violently grabbed his arm. I caught Jeremy Hurst and his little gang bullying another pupil. I intervened. But you didn't use unreasonable force? I look him in the eye. Of course not. Okay, Harry sighs. I'm sorry, but I had to ask. I understand. You should have come to me about this incident. Could have nipped it in the bud. I didn't see any need. I thought the matter was dealt with. I'm sure. But the fact is, the Jeremy Hurst situation is a little sensitive. He didn't look very sensitive when he was tormenting another kid and threatening to smash his phone. This is your first day, so obviously you're still new to the school's dynamics. And I appreciate your stance on bullying, but sometimes things aren't so clear-cut. I know what I saw. He takes off his glasses and rubs at his eyes. I sense that he's not a bad man, just a tired, overworked one, trying to do his best under difficult circumstances and generally failing. The thing is, Jeremy Hurst is one of our top students. He's the captain of the school football team. On the other hand, he could just be a prick. That doesn't excuse bullying, lying. His mother has cancer. I screech to a halt in my tracks. Cancer? Bowel cancer. It's on the tip of my tongue to say shit, which would, under the circumstances, be wildly inappropriate. I see. Look, I know Hurst has some social cohesion and anger management issues. So, that's what we're calling it these days. Harry smiles ruefully. But with his situation, we have to tread carefully. Right, I nod. I think I understand a little better now. Good. I should have run through a few things like this with you personally. School handbooks can't cover everything, can they? No. They really can't, I think. Well, I should probably let you get on. Thank you, and thanks for letting me know about Jeremy Hurst. No problem. We'll catch up later. He pauses. I will still have to mark this on your record. I'm sorry? Your personal record. A complaint like this has to be noted, even if it's unsubstantiated. The pulse beats harder. Hurst. Fucking Hurst. Of course. I force out a tight smile. I understand. He walks to the door. Is she going to die? I ask. Jeremy's mother. He turns and gives me a strange look. The treatment is going as well as can be expected, he says. But this type of cancer, the odds aren't encouraging. Must be tough on Jeremy and his father. Yes, yes, it is. He looks for a moment as if he wants to say something else. Then he gives another of his awkward little nods and closes the door.
tough on his father. I take out my cigarettes and smile. Good, I think.
Good. Fucking karma.
The English block used to stand between the main school building and the canteen, attached by a narrow umbilical cord of corridor that always created a heaving, sweating jam of pupils between lessons, and was hotter than the Hadron Collider in summer. We used to joke you'd end up blacker than Jim Berry, the only mixed-race kid in our school, if you stood in it for too long. Although it was officially called the English Block, to all the kids it was simply the Block. Four stories of concrete ugliness prone to swaying in strong winds. No one liked having lessons in the Block, even before what happened. It was always cold, the windows leaked, and one particular vicious winter, I remember a lesson where we all wore hats and scarves, ice flakes frosted on the inside of the panes. After Chris Manning plummeted from the top, it was closed, and then reopened with new safety precautions, which basically meant making sure that the door to the roof was kept padlocked. At some point in the last two decades, it has been demolished. Where the block once stood, there is now a small, paved square with three benches arranged around a meagre circle of half-dead plants. One bench bears a small plaque in memory of Chris Manning. I sit down on one of the other ones and sneak a cigarette out of my packet. I twist it between my fingers and stare at the paving slabs, wondering which ones hides the spot where he landed. He didn't make a sound. Not as he fell, even when he hit the ground. It was soft, a dull thud. It didn't seem hard enough. I could almost have believed he was still alive, just lying there, taking in the fading autumn sunshine, if it hadn't been for the fact that his body looked oddly deflated, like someone had let all the air out. And of course there was the blood. Spreading out slowly from beneath him, a ruby-red shadow lengthened by the dying sun. "Bloody shame, isn't it?" I start. A short girl with dark hair in a messy ponytail and an abundance of silver in her ears stands in front of me. I didn't hear her approach, but then she's so thin she could have blown in on the wind. For a moment, I think she's an especially forward pupil. Then I notice the lack of uniform, unless a killer's t-shirt, skinny jeans and Doc Martens are the new kit, and the lines around her eyes that belie the initially youthful impression. "Sorry." She gestures at the cigarette I've been fingering restlessly.
"Bloody shame they create the perfect smoking area and then ban you from lighting up on school premises."
"Ah." I look at the cigarette and slip it back into the packet. "Truly a tragedy." She grins and sits down beside me without asking. Normally, that type of unasked-for intimacy would annoy the fuck out of me. For some reason, with Miss Multiple Piercings, it only irritates the hell out of me.
"Sad about the kid, who jumped too."
She shakes her head.
"You ever lost one?"
"A pupil?"
"Well, I don't mean a sock."
"No. I don't think I have."
"Well, you'd remember.
I hope." She pulls out a packet of polos, unwraps one and pops it in her mouth. She offers me the packet. I want to refuse, but find myself taking one.
"A student of mine died. Overdose."
"I'm sorry."
"Yeah, she was a really nice kid. Hard worker, popular. Seemed to have everything going for her, and then two packets of paracetamol and a bottle of vodka. Put herself in a coma. A week later, they had to turn off her life support."
I frown. "I don't remember hearing about that."
"Well, you wouldn't. Kind of got overshadowed by Julia and Ben Morton."
She gives a shrug.
"Always a bigger tragedy, right?"
"I suppose." I pause.
"So, Aren't you going to ask?
What?
The usual. Did you know them? Did you suspect anything was wrong? Did you see any signs?
Well, did you?
Not well, no and yes. Did I not mention? Julia came into school wearing a great big placard around her neck. I intend to kill my son and myself. Have a nice day.
Well, politeness costs nothing.
She chuckles and sticks out her hand. Beth Scattergood, art.
I shake it. Scattergood? Really?
Oh, yeah.
Bet the kids have fun with that one.
Miss Shaggergood is the current bookie's favourite, just ahead of Miss Fattergut's.
Nice.
Yeah. Kids, eh? Gotta love 'em, or you'd get a proper job.
I'm Joe.
I know. Joe Thorne, the replacement.
I've been called worse.
So which are you?
How do you mean?
Only two types of teacher end up at Arnhill Academy. Those who want to make a difference, and those who can't get a job anywhere else. So which are you?
I hesitate. I like to think I make a difference.
Right.
Her voice is heavy with sarcasm.
Well, nice knowing you, Mr. Thorne.
Thanks. Encouraging on my first day. She grins.
We aim to please.
I like her, I realise. The emotion surprises me more than it should. So which are you? I ask.
She stands. The hungry sort. I was on my way to the canteen. You coming? I can introduce you to some of the other misfits who teach here.
I hear the hubbub of the canteen long before we approach it. Once again, it takes me back. The wafting aroma of frying stale oil and something indefinable that you never see served but only ever smell drifting from the extractor fans of schools or old people's homes. Inside, it hasn't changed as much as I expect. Parquet flooring, plastic tables and chairs. The kitchen looks like it's had something of an overhaul since I used to queue for my burger, fried onions and chips. Now it's all chicken and rice, vegetable pasta and salad. I blame Jamie Oliver.
That's some of our lot over there. Come on.
Beth leads me in the direction of a table in a far corner. The teacher's table. Four people sit around it. She rattles through the introductions. Miss Hardy. Susan. A wispy lady with long grey hair and thick glasses. History. Mr. Edwards, James, a good-looking young man with a hipster beard, maths. Miss Hibbert, Colleen, a strong-jawed woman with a military haircut, P.E. And Mr. Saunders, Simon, a lanky figure in a Pink Floyd T-shirt and faded cords, receding hair yanked back into a scraggy ponytail. Sociology. For some reason, I dislike him instantly. Perhaps because he introduces himself by saying, "How's it going, man?" Unless you are in a band or an American surfer, do not use the term man. It makes you look like a dick, as does a ponytail with a receding hairline. You're not fooling anyone. I sit down and he points at me with his fork.
"You look familiar, man. Have we met?"
"I don't think so," I say, carefully unwrapping my tuna sandwich.
"Where were you teaching before you came here?"
"Abroad."
"Whereabouts?"
It takes me a moment to remember the lie.
"Botswana."
"Really? Mike's girlfriend taught out there for a while."
"Of course she fucking did."
He smiles.
"Warang?"
I consider the odds.
"Warang? Not a place, too obvious. Must be an introduction. Not hello, as we've already done that, so it must mean..."
"I'm good, thanks," I say pleasantly. "You?" The smile recedes faster than his hair. I take a bite of sandwich and wonder if anyone would care if I dragged him outside and threw him under the nearest bus.
"I hear you're local to Arnhill,"
Colleen asks, thankfully changing the subject.
"I grew up here," I say.
"And you came back?"
James asks incredulously and only half-joking. For my sins.
Well, we are glad to have you,
Susan offers.
It's been difficult finding a replacement after, well, after Mrs. Morton.
Yeah, Simon says. You don't have to be mad to work here, but it helps. He chortles at his own joke. Beth eyes him coldly.
Julia suffered from depression. She wasn't mad.
He sneers at her. Right, because smashing your own kid's face in is completely sane. He takes a hearty bite of pasta and chews noisily. I turn to Beth.
Did everyone know about Julia's depression?
She was quite open about it, Beth says. She went through a bad spell after her separation from Ben's dad. I think moving here was supposed to be a fresh start.
Some fresh start, I think.
She was on medication, Susan adds, but apparently she'd stopped taking it.
How did she get hold of a gun?
Her family own a farm near Oxton. It was her father's.
Obviously, James says, if any of us had suspected there was anything wrong.
What, I think. What would you have done?
Asked her if she was okay, and smiled with relief when she said that she was fine.
Job done. Concern box ticked. The truth is, none of us wants to know. Not really. Because then we might have to care. And who has the time for that?
Obviously, I say. Simon snaps his fingers and points at me again.
Stockford Academy.
My stomach lurches.
That's where I remember you from, he says.
I worked there as a supply teacher before I got the job here.
And now he's said it, I vaguely recall a skinny bloke with bad dress sense and halitosis. We weren't in the same department, but still.
Really?
Well, I wasn't there very long, so...
Yeah, you left kind of suddenly. What happened?
You piss off the head. No, nothing like that. Pissing off didn't even come close.
Weird, though.
He frowns and nods at my bad leg.
I don't remember you having a limp back then.
I stare at him. Then you must be confusing me with someone else. I've had the limp since I was a kid. The moment lingers a little longer than is comfortable. Susan intervenes.
What happened, if you don't mind me asking?
Actually, I do. But I kind of brought this one on myself.
I was 15. I was in a car accident with my dad and my little sister. We came off the road and hit a tree. Annie and my dad died instantly. My leg was crushed. Took half a dozen bits of metal to put it back together again.
Oh, God, Susan says. I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
How old was your sister?
Beth asks.
She was 8.
They regard me with sad, sympathetic eyes, apart from Simon, who, I'm pleased to see, can't meet my gaze. Anyway, I say, it was a long time ago, and fortunately I had my heart set on being a teacher, not a tap dancer, so here I am. They laugh a little nervously. The conversation moves on. I've played it well. I'm a good man. An honest man. A man who has faced tragedy, bears the scars, but still has a sense of humour. I'm also a liar. I didn't lose my sister in a car crash. And I didn't have the limp back then.
6. People say time is a great healer. They're wrong. Time is simply a great eraser. It rolls on and on regardless, eroding our memories, chipping away at those great big boulders of misery, until there's nothing left but sharp little fragments, still painful but small enough to bear. Broken hearts don't mend. Time just takes the pieces and grinds them to dust. I sit back in one of the cottage's creaky armchairs and take a deep swig of beer. It's been a long day. The first full day I've taught for a while. I'm feeling it, both mentally and physically.
My bad leg throbs. And even the 4 codeine tablets I've taken are doing little to ease the insistent, dull ache. I won't sleep tonight. So my solution is to get drunk enough to pass out. Self-medication. The room is dim, lit only by a single table lamp and the crackling log burner. I made it to an out-of-town supermarket and stocked up on the essentials: pizza, ready meals, coffee, cigarettes, and alcohol. On the way back, I spotted a farmhouse/B&B selling logs. No one answered the door when I knocked, even though a battered Ford Focus sat outside. There were 2 child seats in the back and a sign in the rear window: Little Monsters on Board. A basket had been left beside the logs. £5 per bag, pay here. There looked to be about £30 in the basket. I stared at the crumpled notes for a moment, thought about the child seats, and chucked in a fiver. Then I picked up a bag and drove back to the supermarket for fire lighters. It's taken me 6 of these and a lot of swearing to get the damn thing lit. However, now, for the first time since I moved in, the room is filled with a pleasant dry heat. I can practically see the damp retreating from the walls. Aside from the ramshackle furniture, lack of any personal mementos, and the fact that 2 people died here, I almost feel at home. A notebook is open on my lap. On the first page I've written 4 names, with scribbled notes beside them. Chris Manning, Nick Fletcher, Marie Gibson, and of course, Stephen Hurst. The old gang back together. On paper, at least. The ones who were there when it happened. The only ones who knew. Fletch, I have discovered, now runs a plumbing business in Arnhill. Hurst is on the council. Marie, I couldn't find anything about online, but she may have married, changed her name. Beside Chris's name, I have simply written deceased, although that doesn't really cover it. Not at all. At the top of the next page are 2 names, Julia and Ben Morton. Beneath, I've jotted more notes, mostly gleaned from the internet and the newspapers. Neither wholly reliable, I know. If newspapers are the place where facts become stories, the internet is the place where stories become conspiracy theories. What I do know is this. Julia had a history of depression. She'd just finalized a divorce from Ben's father, Michael Morton, a solicitor. She had stopped her medication, requested a leave of absence, and taken Ben out of school. Oh, and after she bludgeoned her son to death, before she blew her own head off, she wrote 3 words in blood on the wall of Ben's bedroom. Not my son. In summary, hardly the actions of a balanced mind. I've printed off 2 pictures and paperclipped them inside the notebook. The first is of Julia. It looks like it was taken at a work event. She wears a smart suit, hair tied in a loose ponytail. Her smile is wide, but her eyes are tired and guarded. "Take your picture and leave me alone," her face says. I wonder if that's the reason the newspaper chose it. This is a woman about to break, a woman on the edge. Or maybe just a woman irritated at being forced to pose for a stupid photo. Ben's is a school photo. His smile is wide and engaging, front 2 teeth slightly crooked, tied on up neatly for, probably, the first time ever. The reporters have trotted out all the usual platitudes: popular, a good pupil, plenty of friends, a bright future. They say nothing of the real boy, simply a cut-and-paste job from their stock dead child folders. Only one article hints at something more. A shadow skimming beneath the sun-dappled surface of Ben's imagined existence. In the weeks before he died, an unnamed school source claimed that Ben had been acting strangely, getting into trouble, absent from classes. He was weird, not himself. I think about the words Julia wrote. Not my son.
An icy fingernail caresses the top of my spine. I chuck the notebook onto the coffee table. My phone rings. Enter Sandman, piercing the cozy silence. I tense, then pick it up and glance at the screen. Brendan. I press accept call. Hello? How's it going? Good question. Still working on the answer? I wait. Brendan is not the type of friend who calls just to inquire about my well-being. If there are no reports to the contrary, he presumes I'm alive, which is good enough. Someone was asking about you in the pub the other night, he says. Someone. A woman. A smart blonde. Pretty, but kind of hard. My stomach cramps. My bad leg throbs harder. Did you speak to her? Feck no. I slipped out as soon as I saw her. Some women just radiate bad news. Okay. Don't go back. But they serve the finest steak and kidney pie outside of my dear old mammy's kitchen. Get a cookbook.
Are you shitting me?
No shitting. Don't go back.
Christ!
There's the click of a lighter and the sound of inhaling.
What did you do? Pawn her jewellery? Run off with her life savings?
Worse.
You know what my dear old mammy would say?
I have a feeling you're going to tell me.
The quickest way to bury a man is to give him a spade.
Meaning?
When the feck are you going to stop digging?
When I find the treasure.
The only thing you're going to find, my friend, is an early grave.
I love our little chats. They're so uplifting.
If you want uplifting, watch Oprah.
I have a plan.
You have a death wish.
I just need a bit of time.
He sighs. Have you ever thought you need professional help?
When I've sorted this out, I'll think about it.
You do that.
He ends the call. I do think about it. For about 10 seconds. I owe Brendan that. We've known each other for around 3 years. Shared a flat for a year and a half. He was there for me when no one else was. But Brendan is a recovering alcoholic. That means he is into things like confession, forgiveness, and redemption, while I am more into keeping secrets, bearing grudges, and holding on to resentment. Sometimes, I wonder how the hell we even became friends. I guess, like a lot of relationships, it was a mixture of circumstance and alcohol, on my part at least. We used to see each other regularly in a pub close to where I lived. Casual hellos morphed into conversation one night. We began to sit together and chat over a drink, orange juice for Brendan, Guinness or whiskey for me. Brendan's company was easy, undemanding, about the only thing in my life that was. The foundations of my comfortable middle-class existence were fast crumbling beneath my feet. My job was hanging by a thread, and I was struggling to make the rent on my apartment. When I was 6 months in arrears, my landlord came round with his two burly brothers, kicked me out and changed the locks. My choices of accommodation were suddenly limited. Should I choose the bedsit with the suspicious stains on the walls, or the basement flat with mould and what sounded like a tap-dancing ensemble living upstairs? Not to mention, I was restricted to looking in the sort of neighbourhoods that Batman might think twice about sauntering around on a dark night. That was when Brendan suggested I move in with him.
Feck! I've got a spare room that's just wasting gas and electricity.
That's a kind offer, but I can't afford much in the way of rent.
Forget the rent.
I stared at him. No, I can't. He gave me a look.
As my dear old mammy would say, you can't fight the wolves at your door when you're wrestling a lion in your living room.
I considered. I thought about my other options. Forget lions. I might well wake up to find rats nibbling my eyeballs.
Okay. And thanks. Thank me by sorting yourself out.
My losing streak can't last forever. For a moment his face clouded.
It better not. From what I've heard, you owe money to people who don't take installments. They take kneecaps.
I'm sorting it. And I'll pay you back, I promise.
Too feckin' right you will, he grinned.
I enjoy a nice back rub before bed. Don't hold back on the massage oil.
I reach for my beer, realize it's empty, and crumple the can in my hand. I stand to get another, then decide a visit to the bathroom might be in order. I walk across the living room and flick on the hallway light. It grudgingly ebbs into life. I place my foot on the first stair. It creaks predictably. As I climb the narrow staircase, I try not to think about Julia Morton dragging her son's body up here, step by creaking laborious step. An 11-year-old boy is heavy, and dead weight is heavier. I remember. The landing is cold. There's no radiator up here. But that's not it. This isn't normal cold. Not the cold I experienced when I first walked into the cottage. This cold is different. Creeping cold. A phrase I haven't thought about since I was a kid. The type of cold that wraps itself around your bones and settles like a lump of ice in your intestines. I can hear something, too. Faint, but persistent. An odd rustling, clicking sound, like air in the pipes. I stand and listen. It's coming from the bathroom. I push open the door and pull on the tattered old light cord. The light flickers on with an irritating low hum, like a dying mosquito. The cold is worse in here. The noise is louder, too. Not air in the pipes, no. That clicking, skittering sound is something else. Something more familiar, something more alive. And it's coming from the toilet. The seat and lid are down. Not because I'm in touch with my feminine side, but because I have a slight phobia of open holes, drains, overflows, any hole in the ground. Last night before bed, I went around and placed all the plugs in the plug holes. Now, I reach forward and tentatively lift the toilet lid. Shit. I leap back, so fast I almost lose my footing and crash to the floor. Somehow I manage to grab hold of the sink and keep my balance. I don't have such great control over my full bladder. A spurt of warm urine trickles down my leg. I barely notice. The inside of the toilet bowl is moving, teeming with a mass of small, shiny black bodies, clickety-click-clicking, as they scurry around like a moving sea of excrement. Christ! A shiver of repulsion ripples through me, along with the faint echo of a memory. It's the shadows. The shadows are moving. I lean on the sink, breathing heavily. Beetles. Fucking beetles. After a moment, I step forward and raise the lid again. The swarming increases, like they sense I'm here. A couple make a break for it and start to scramble up towards the rim. I hastily slam the lid back down, trapping them between the two bits of plastic. They crack with a satisfying crunch. How the hell did they get in there? The ball must be dry, so they've come up the pipes, but still. I reach for the bleach. Take a deep breath, flip the lid once more, and squirt the whole bottle down the toilet, drenching the scuttling insects. The chittering and skittering increases. Some scramble up the side of the bowl. I grab the loo brush and force them back down. Then I flush the toilet, again and again until the cistern groans and there's nothing left in the bottom but a small scum of water and a few floating black corpses. Just for good measure, I grab the loo roll and stuff it down the waste pipe to plug it up. I sit down on the edge of the bath. Or rather, my legs give, and the edge of the bath rises to greet me with a hard bump. Beetles. Fuck, fuck, fuck. My heart is hammering. I'm sweating despite the cold. I need a drink and a cigarette. But more than that, I need a fix. For the first time since I arrived here, for the first time in a long while, I need something to calm my nerves and steady my shaking hands.
I fumble in my pocket for my phone. BT aren't coming to install broadband until next week, but I have 3G. Just. Online is second, even third best. But like an alcoholic reaching for the meths when every other bottle has been drained, needs must. I bring up a web page. Vegas Gold, it declares in inappropriately glittery gold writing. The irony of playing Vegas Gold while sitting on the edge of a mold-encrusted bath in jeans wet with urine is not lost on me. My thumb hovers over the link. And that's when I hear the crash from downstairs. What the hell? I hobble as fast as I can back down the narrow staircase and into the living room. A blast of cold evening air smacks me around the face. The curtains tussle and grapple in the wind. A jagged hole gapes in the living room window, and shards of glass litter the floorboards. Tires squeal, an engine revs, and the high-pitched whine of a moped fades into the distance. In the middle of the room, I spot the source of the damage. A brick, with a piece of paper wrapped around it, secured with a rubber band. How original. I walk forward, kicking the slivers of glass out of my way, and pick up the brick. I unpeel the paper. It's thin and lined, torn from an exercise book. As welcome messages go, it leaves something to be desired. Fuck off, cripple. 7. You know you're getting older when the police are getting younger. I'm not sure what it says about you when the police are getting smaller. I stare down. Way down. At PC Cheryl Taylor. At least, I think that's what she said her name was. Her tone is brusque, her demeanor cool. I get the impression she would rather not be here. Perhaps I'm keeping her from a major heist or the evening chip butty run. So, you say someone threw the brick through your window at approximately 8 or 7 this evening? Yes. Approximately 1 hour ago. So whoever did it is long gone by now. Still, at least it gave me the chance to change my jeans.
Did you see anything?
I saw a large red house brick in the middle of my newly air-conditioned living room. She gives me a look. It's one I'm familiar with. I seem to get it a lot from women.
I meant anything else.
No, but I heard a moped accelerating away. She makes some more notes, then she bends down and picks up the house brick. Do you need to bag that or something? Check for fingerprints.
This is Arn Hill, not CSI, she says, putting it down again.
Oh, right. Of course. Sorry. For a moment there, I thought you were interested in catching whoever did this. She looks like she's going to retort, then bites back whatever comment she was about to make and simply says,
The note.
I hand it to her. She studies it.
Not so hot on spelling.
Actually, I say, I don't think that's a mistake. I think it's deliberate to throw me off track. One thin eyebrow rises.
Go on.
I'm an English teacher, I say patiently. So I see bad spelling a lot. This isn't one of those words that pupils get wrong, and if they do, then they get the whole thing wrong. They don't just miss out a P. She considers this.
Okay. So can you think of anyone who would do something like this? Any enemies? People with a grudge?
I almost laugh out loud. You have no idea, I think. Then I consider. I'm pretty sure Hurst or one of his mates is responsible. But I've no witnesses, no evidence, and bearing in mind the little chat I had with Harry this morning... Christ, was it only this morning? I don't want to put my job in jeopardy. Not yet, anyway.
Mr. Thorne?
To be honest, I only moved in recently. I've not had time to piss too many people off yet.
But it seems you're working on it.
Obviously.
Right, well, we'll look into this, but it's probably just kids. We've had some trouble with kids from your school before.
Really? What sort of trouble?
The usual. Vandalism, trespass, disorderly behaviour.
Ah, takes me back.
If you want, an officer can come to school, give them a bit of a talk on social responsibility, that type of thing.
Will that do any good?
Last time my sergeant did it, he came back to find someone had let all his tyres down.
Maybe not then.
Okay. Well, here's your crime number for insurance purposes. Any more trouble, call us right away.
I will. She pauses at the door, seems to debate something.
Look, I don't want to make your night even worse.
I think about the skittering, scuttling beetles. It'd be hard.
But did anyone tell you about this place?
You mean what happened here?
You know.
It came up.
And it doesn't bother you?
I don't believe in ghosts. She glances around and can't quite disguise the shudder of distaste that scurries across her face. Something clicks. You found them, didn't you? She hesitates before answering.
My sergeant and I were first on the scene, yes.
That must have been difficult.
It's part of the job. You deal with it.
But you still wouldn't want to live here?
A small shrug. You can never really clean away blood. Doesn't matter how much bleach you use, how hard you scrub. It's always there, even if you can't see it.
Comforting. Thanks for that.
You asked.
Can I ask you something else?
I suppose, she says cautiously.
Could there be any other explanation for what happened here?
No sign of a break-in, no evidence of a third party involved. Believe me, we looked.
What about Ben's father?
At a client dinner that night.
So you think that Julia Morton just cracked, killed her son and herself?
I think you're asking a lot of questions for someone not bothered by it.
Just curious.
Well, don't be. It won't do you any favours here.
She tucks her notebook into her pocket.
And I was only letting you know about the cottage in case the letting agent hadn't informed you of all the facts.
Thanks. But I don't think the cottage is a problem.
No.
She gives me another look, one I can't quite read.
I think you're probably right.
The glazier arrives 15 minutes later. He whacks up a board over the broken window, informs me there'll be £50, and that a new window will take about a week. I tell him that's fine. I can live without the view of the road. He also gives me an odd look. Not my audience. After he's gone, I sink a couple more bourbons, smoke a cigarette leaning out of the back door, then decide I've had enough, more than enough for one day, and head back upstairs to bed. The cold has gone. It's just the normal chill of the cottage. I approach the bathroom gingerly, but the toilet is still empty. I remove the loo roll and relieve myself, wash and brush my teeth, pull off the light switch and shut the door. Then I have second thoughts. I walk back downstairs and pick up the house brick. I carry it back into the bathroom and place it on top of the toilet lid. Just in case. I don't dream. I have nightmares. Normally, the alcohol helps with that. Not tonight. I'm walking up the stairs in my childhood house, except in the way that dreams are, it isn't my childhood house.
Not quite.
The stairs are much narrower and steeper, and they wind around in a spiral. I can hear a noise below me in the darkness, a skittering, chittering noise. Shadows swarm around the bottom. Above me, I can hear another noise, a terrible high-pitched keening sound, like an animal in pain, interspersed with cries.
Abby eyes! Abby eyes! Kiss the boys and make them cry!
I don't want to climb the staircase, but I have no choice. Every time I glance back, I see a few more of the stairs have disappeared into darkness. The shadows are creeping, just like the cold, and they're gaining on me. I keep climbing, the stairs winding endlessly up ahead of me, and then suddenly I'm on the landing. I look back.
The stairs aren't there anymore. The shadows have crept up and swallowed them. Now they mill and scuttle restlessly, inches from my feet. There are three doors, all closed. I push open the first door. My dad is inside. He sits on the bed. Well, sits isn't quite the word. He lolls, like a puppet with its strings cut. His head lies on his shoulder, as though it's having a rest from the business of being on top of things. Glistening tendons and stringy red strips of muscle barely hold it to his body. When the car hit the tree, a jagged sliver of windscreen pretty much decapitated him. He opens his mouth, and a strange wheezing noise hisses out. I realize it's my name. Joey! He tries to stand. I pull the door shut again, heart thumping, legs trembling. I move on to the next door. This one will be worse, I know. But just like a character in a bad horror movie, I know I'm going to open it. I push at the door, then step back. The room is filled with flies. Blue bottles rise in a dark, buzzing cloud. Somewhere among them I can see two figures. Julia and Ben. At least, I think it must be Julia and Ben. It's hard to tell as Julia is missing most of her head, and Ben has no face. Just a red and white mass of blood, bone and gristle. They stand, shadowy figures amidst the flies. And then I realize they're made of flies themselves. As I stare at them, they dissolve and pour towards me. I throw myself through the door and slam it shut. I can hear the flies batting themselves against the wood in a furious swarm. Wake up, I think. Wake up, wake up, wake up. But my subconscious is not about to let me off so easily. I turn towards the last door. My hand reaches out and twists the handle. It swings slowly open. This room is empty, except for a bed and Abby eyes. She lies in the center, eyelids closed. I walk forward and pick her up. Her eyes snap open. Pink plastic lips twist into a smile.
She's behind you.
I turn. Annie stands in the doorway. She's wearing her pajamas. Pale pink, decorated with small white sheep. The clothes she was wearing the night of the crash. Except that's wrong. That wasn't what my sister was wearing when she died. Go away, I say. She shuffles towards me and stretches out her arms. Go away. Then she opens her mouth and a swarm of beetles pours out of it. I try to run, but my bad leg gets tangled and I crash to the floor. Behind me I can hear the chittering, skittering of hard shells and busy little legs. I can feel them crawling up my ankles, burrowing into my skin. I try to swat and brush them off. They scuttle up my arms and neck into my mouth and down my throat. I can't breathe. I'm choking on stinking black bodies. I wake, sweating and shaking, batting at my bedclothes, which are tangled and knotted around my naked body. Shards of daylight poke through the semi-drawn curtains and jab at my eyeballs. I squint at my alarm clock, just as it starts to ring, sending peals of agony through my pounding head. I roll over and groan. Time for school. 8.
Sir?
Yes, Lucas. I point wearily at the arm waving in the air, and then, before he can say anything, I raise my own hand. If this is another question about Tinder, I think we've already covered the fact that dating apps weren't exactly a thing in Romeo and Juliet's time. Another hand shoots up. Josh?
What about Snapchat?
The class ripples with laughter. I smother a smile. Okay, you've given me an idea.
I have, sir?
Yep. Take one of the chapters we've read and rewrite it as if it was set in the modern day. Pay particular attention to parallels and the themes of tragedy and calamity. More hands shoot into the air. I pick one. Alicia.
What's a parallel?
Something similar or corresponding to.
What's a calamity?
This class.
The bell rings for lunch. I try not to wince at the noise. Okay, get out of here. I look forward to reading those essays tomorrow. Chairs scrape and clatter as the children hastily make their escape. Doesn't matter how interesting you make your lessons or how enthusiastic the pupils, the ringing of the bell always sends them scattering from the classroom like inmates released from prison. I start to gather my books and stuff them into my satchel. A familiar dark head pokes around the classroom door.
Hey.
Hi. Beth saunters in. Nirvana t-shirt, ripped jeans and Vans today, and perches on the edge of my desk.
So I hear someone threw a brick through your window last night.
News travels fast in Arnhill.
Yeah, but it never leaves.
I chuckle. Who told you?
One of the teaching assistant's cousins works part-time with a woman whose brother works for the police.
Whoa. Better sources than CNN.
More accurate, usually.
She cocks an eyebrow, which I presume is my cue to confirm or deny reports. I shrug.
I guess someone didn't like my lesson plans.
You think it was one of the kids here?
It seems most likely.
You have a prime suspect?
You could say that. I hesitate. Jeremy Hurst?
Oh.
You don't sound surprised.
St. Jeremy? No. I heard you had a run-in.
You really do have great hearing. If you ever hear what the winning lottery numbers are... She grins.
Like I'd tell you.
So what do you know about... There's a knock on the half-open door. We both look up. A slightly overweight girl with streaked blonde hair and too much makeup for a school day peers in.
This Mr. Anderson's class?
No, next door, Beth says.
Right.
She huffs and storms off.
You're welcome,
Beth shouts after her.
She looks back at me. Why don't we take this conversation out of the classroom? I believe it's lunchtime.
The canteen?
Screw that, I was thinking more like the pub.
The worn chairs and benches are gone. The migraine-inducing multicoloured carpet has been replaced by shiny wooden floorboards. Tasteful lamps are arranged on the windowsills, and an array of fine wines and bourbons are available at the bar. There's also an exciting new gastropub menu. Actually, none of that is true. The Fox hasn't changed at all, not since the last time I was in here, 25 years ago. The same old jukebox sits in the corner, probably stacked with the same old tunes. Even some of the patrons don't look as if they have changed, or moved, since the last century.
I know, Beth says, catching me surveying the pub. I take you to all the best places.
Actually, I was just thinking that you can probably still smell my vomit in the toilets.
Nice. I forgot you grew up here.
Well, not literally in here.
Well, I don't know.
So this was your local?
Kind of. Officially, I wasn't old enough to drink. Unofficially, the landlord wasn't too stringent about that sort of thing.
I turn to the bar. I half expect to see Gypsy still serving behind it, but instead a young woman with huge hooped earrings and hair in a ponytail so tight her eyebrows look like they're being held against their will scowls invitingly at me.
Getcha.
I look at Beth.
Just a Diet Coke, thanks.
I glance longingly at the whiskey, then say reluctantly,
2 Diet Cokes, please.